This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome to part two of today's Intelligent Medicine podcast. As I said earlier in part one, today it's sort of a potpourri of stories that ended up on the cutting room floor. There just simply isn't enough time with all the great guests that we have during our weekday podcasts and all the great callers and questions that we have during our weekend program to squeeze in all these important stories. So they accumulate, and they're too important not to share with you. So here goes. This story has to do with paleo lifestyle. You know, you heard of the paleo diet. You know, we try to recreate the conditions of our ancient forebears in terms of diet. And we recognize that they did not have domesticated grains or dairy, and they may have subsisted on some amounts of animal products, very different from the animal products that we consume now, because the game was wild, and they sometimes ate things like worms and insects, termites, ants, but also they had plenty of fruits and vegetables, but the fruits and vegetables weren't domesticated. They were more compact, less laden with starch and less laden with sugar, which makes them more palatable and more appealing in the markets. So, you know, we could debate the merits of the paleo diet, but the paleo lifestyle, has to do with a lot of factors. It has to do with, for example, paleo sleep. Paleo sleep refers to a pattern of sleep which occurred before they invented candles and electric light bulbs. When it got dark, you went to sleep, and in northern climes, it gets dark pretty early, so the people may have had what's called a bifurcated sleep, where they went to sleep when it was dark, and then they got up in the middle of the night, and sat around the campfire, maybe told stories, hung out, and then they went back to sleep for a few more hours because the nights were long. And some people get really bent out of shape because they can't just hit the pillow and sleep a steady 8 hours. They wake up in the middle of the night, they want to read, they want to do something. But that may actually be more suited to our genetic makeup to have paleo sleep, at least during wintertime. Also, paleo exercise. Lots and lots of physical activity, but not necessarily linear physical activity. I'm not sure that paleo man engaged a lot in running marathons. They may have had to track game for long periods of time, but there was maybe a period of time where they did some run walking, and then they caught the game, and when they had enough to eat, they probably relished the opportunity to sit around and be couch potatoes. They didn't go on the elliptical, you know, or on the treadmill or the Stairmaster because, well, you know, every day they had to hit the gym. So paleo exercise may be more sporadic bursts of exercise than, you know, a daily consistent regimen, you know, every day is the same thing. Okay, but here's another element of the paleo lifestyle. Major health benefits linked to indoor temperature variation, study finds. You think about it. Do you realize how temperature-controlled your life is? Because, I can remember back, I grew up in Los Angeles, which is a pretty hot place, at a time where our home did not have an air conditioner. Our home didn't have an air conditioner, and there were times where temperature was well over 100 degrees in Los Angeles. Nowadays, everybody in Los Angeles has an air conditioner. That's a big drain on power, but we seem to be able to meet the challenge of delivering power. Also, when it came to cold, the old story is, why do they wear sweaters all the time and inside in England? Well, those castles had, and those, Downton Abbey type manors, were pretty drafty. They didn't have, such good radiators, forced hot air, and temperatures could get pretty cold. You had a fireplace and, even in a bedroom so that you could stay warm. You look at colonial houses and they actually, had a system where they would bring hot coals up in these little baskets to, heat the bed because it was pretty cold. So, what they're saying here in this article, new research reveals how exposure to mildly cold or warm environments outside the standard comfort zone inside buildings of, we'll translate from the centigrade, 21 to 22 degrees. I guess that translates to 68 to 72 degrees. So outside that comfort zone, challenging cold or warm temperatures increase metabolism and energy expenditure, which may help to tackle obesity. For those with type 2 diabetes, exposure to mild coldness influences glucose metabolism. And after 10 days of intermittent cold, patients had increased insulin sensitivity by more than 40%. Check it out. These results for diabetes treatment are comparable with the best pharmaceutical solutions available. So, what they're saying here is save money on heat, turn off the radiator, turn your apartment or home into a meat locker, and you can improve your metabolism. And it's not even a matter about terrible dietary deprivation. So, the authors of this study advocate that living conditions in modern buildings, such as homes and offices, should be dynamic and incorporate drifting temperatures in order to support healthy human environments. Such measures should go hand in hand with the classical lifestyle factors such as diet and physical exercise. The research is entitled Healthy Excursions Outside the Thermal Comfort Zone. And one of the authors writes, it is previously been assumed that stable fixed indoor temperatures would satisfy comfort and health in most people. However, the research indicates that mild cold and variable temperatures may have a positive effect on our health and at the same time are acceptable or may even create pleasure. Well, I don't know about that. We're so used to our creature comforts that, being too hot or too cold, is outside our comfort zone. But, interesting study. And this actually, is a strategy that I tend to follow is that, I like to walk to work. And there's some days, here in New York, and I remember not particularly this winter because this winter is relatively mild. It rarely got, below 20 degrees this winter. But there was, last winter, where there were some single-digit days, and in fact, the temperatures dipped below zero here in New York, a rare occurrence. For those of you who live in Minnesota, where that's not too uncommon, that's pretty cold for New York City, zero Fahrenheit. So I make it a practice of walking to work almost whatever the weather. If I'm walking in a monsoon, I feel it increases resiliency, and it cold conditions me. And the other thing I do is I swim in cold water. And it's now May. And, Facebook prompts you with pictures from the past. And the picture that I got this week was from 6 years ago where I'm standing in the water in the Atlantic, wearing a wetsuit, of course. And it wasn't too pleasant. But I try to swim and challenge myself in water that is cold because acclimatization to cold temperatures and indeed hot temperatures running on a hot day, as long as you're not dehydrated or straining your heart, these stresses actually are good for the body. And A, they help you lose weight. B, they help you with insulin response, which will fend off diabetes and cardiometabolic disease. But, there's a little bit like the old adage, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger and increases your resilience. So, give some thought to this in your climate-controlled environments. Pull back on the air conditioning, and be sparing of the heat, because there may be a true benefit of these excursions in temperature that are really part of our paleo heritage. Our bodies are not designed to be climate controlled at every instant of our existence. You know, we jump from our house into our air-conditioned car and go to our air-conditioned office, and maybe that's not all to the good. Let's pause now to let one of our sponsors share some information with us, and we'll be right back. This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, an effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. It's a safe, easy way to lower your blood pressure naturally, and it's so effective it works for 9 in 10 people. The Zona Plus is a high-tech smart device that guides you through a patented therapy that's personalized to your unique physiology. To find out more, go to tryzona.com or call toll-free 888-408-6141. As a listener to Intelligent Medicine, you can get $50 off and free shipping. Just use the coupon code Hoffman at checkout at tryzona.com. Okay, thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting our sponsors. They make it possible for us to provide you with all this free information. Okay, it's coming up to the time of year when new doctors start to come into the hospital. I remember this date like it was today, July 1st. And you'll get a little heads up. I know it's not July 1st yet for most of you, but I remember July 1st because it was the most stressful experience of my entire life. And it's good in a way, because I look back on that and I say, if I could tackle that, I could tackle anything. Because for 4 years in medical school, we were taught theory. And on July 1st, we became doctors under real battlefield conditions in a New York metropolitan hospital, with all the attendant chaos. And I remember it like today because I was inundated with patients. I had a serious GI bleeder, a guy who had just taken a few Advils for pain and ended up vomiting buckets and buckets of blood. He almost died. I spent the entire night with him, and there were also four other patients that I had to attend to. And I was overwhelmed. And I always say about that time of my life, that first year of my medical training, it is a miracle. It's a miracle that I didn't kill anyone. Maybe came close, but fortunately nobody died due to my overwork and inexperience. So there's an article in, this is in Journal of the American Medical Association, an authoritative medical journal. And the theme is whether or not you should go to the hospital in and around July 1st, especially if it's a teaching hospital. And the title of the article is, Are End of Rotation Resident Transitions of Care Dangerous? And they did a study. So they looked at, by the way, precisely where I trained, they looked at data from 230,000 patients at 10 university-associated Veterans Affairs hospitals. I trained at Manhattan VA Hospital here in New York, in which interns, their first-year residents and upper-level residents, manage patients under attending physician supervision. The attending was always sort of lurking in the background, but he didn't sleep in the hospital. He was there to advise you on call. He'd come in the morning and ask how the night went. But we were supervised, but to some extent we were thrown to the wolves. And that's just the nature of medical training. And we were novices. There was a huge difference between our poise and our experience on July 1st versus June 30th, 364 days later. Because by then we were veterans. We knew the drill. So what they found was that, this is scary, inpatient mortality was significantly higher for patients when only interns were involved in their care. Well, that should never happen. Interns need to be supervised. There was a death rate of 3.5% when interns were in charge versus 2% in a control group where there was more adequate supervision. When interns and upper-level residents were involved, there still was a problem. 4% death rate versus 2.1%. But there wasn't a lot of difference between a control group and a group supervised by upper-level residents. So they found 30-day and 90-day death rates were significantly higher in transitional patients. Transitioned patients means patients who were carried over. In other words, there's a changing of the guard. You know, let's say you go in the hospital on June 28th, and then all of a sudden they shuffle the deck. You got a whole bunch of these new doctors just out of medical school, inexperienced. And that's, it turns out, for real, that is a risky time for patients. So they say here in this article, these less experienced physicians deserve more direct observation of their rotation, transition, communication, and processes. A structured approach to rotation transitions might improve patient outcomes. Well, how much of a structured approach did we have? We had 3x5 cards. You know, each 3x5 card was said to encapsulate all the information you needed to know about, you know, the 10 or 12 patients that you inherited from your predecessor. And all of a sudden, you were cut loose on those patients. And it was kind of an ad hoc process. And, you know, sink or swim. Learn how to do it. And, you know, hopefully more and more we're recognizing that these new doctors, while wonderfully educated, need a lot of help. And they hopefully will get more and better supervision in the future as they begin to work on new patients right after the July 1st transition. Okay, our healthcare system is in trouble. And we can't even decide how to administer it, whether to defund Obamacare, repeal and replace. That is up in the air. And so clearly we got a problem. And at the present rate, we won't be able to afford our health care. So I'm not about to embark on providing a political answer here, because that's a morass. But here's a small contribution to a solution. Headline, modest increases in kids' physical activity could avert billions in medical costs. Even getting in just a little more exercise in childhood can reduce obesity and related illnesses in adulthood. This comes to us from the Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health. The summary of the article is that increasing the percentage of elementary school children in the United States who participate in, get this, just 25 minutes of physical activity 3 times a week from 32%, which is the current level, that's sad. It's less than one-third of kids do even this minimal amount of exercise, 25 minutes of physical activity 3 times a week. Increase it from 32% to 50% would avoid $21.9 billion in medical costs and lost wages over the course of their lifetimes, new research suggests. Okay, there's a problem because we're seeing more and more kids who, as it's kind of a perfect storm because on the one hand, schools have a lot of curriculum and they have to shove a lot of facts into kids and they have a lot of benchmarks to reach in terms of educational goals. And they also are strapped for funds, so they cut corners on physical education. And the result is that more and more kids are sitting in classes, and particularly active kids, they don't like that, so they are diagnosed with hyperactivity attention deficit disorder and they're prescribed medications so they sit still and learn. That's number one problem. Another problem stems from, I think, the increased role of litigation in America, which is has to do with, you know, when we were kids, you know, we'd run around, you know, we'd fall off the jungle gym and, you know, put an ice pack on our head. Now, you know, you got to go to the hospital, you got to get a CT scan. You know, they're running scared, and actually there's a lot less rugged physical activity because they're afraid of liability. Liability is a big issue in reducing the amount of challenging physical activities that kids are allowed to be exposed to in school. Then there's the diets, and I think we've stoked up the diets of kids with a lot more sugar in the form of cola beverage and sweetened drinks since I was a kid. Yeah, it was available, you know, 60 years ago, but less potent varieties. It's not as ubiquitous as these beverages are now. And then there's the advent of devices, which have kids sitting there and peering into their iPhones or their tablets, gaming, you know, or on Snapchat, texting, and so on. Also, there's an element of sleep deprivation. Kids are battered because they don't sleep enough. And so there's the element of safety, too, is that, you know, as protective as my parents were, they were overly protective, but I was a free-range kid. I could just kind of roam around the neighborhood, get on my bike, and ride around. They weren't particularly worried that I was going to get attacked or kidnapped. I wasn't allowed to have a paper route like some of the other kids. That made me feel like I was really being coddled. But I was free to, you know, walk around and play in the alley, play in, you know, peer into the garbage cans, see what I could find. You know, and I wasn't so highly structured as kids are today. There was a lot of free time to run around. So what they're saying here is that a small increase in the frequency of exercise among kids aged 8 through 11 would also result in 340,000 fewer obese and overweight youth, which is a reduction of more than 4%. And if, you know, they run the statistics here, and this is a model, so, you know, it's unclear if this really would happen. But it's a projection. If all current 8 through 11-year-olds in the United States exercise 25 minutes a day, three times a week, the researchers suggest that $62.3 billion in medical costs and lost wages over the course of their lifetimes could be avoided, and in 1.2 million fewer youths would be overweight or obese. That's a lot. So this is based on the assumption that a high body mass index at 18 is associated with a high BMI throughout adulthood, and subsequent risk of developing diseases such as diabetes and heart disease associated with being overweight or obese, which can lead to high medical costs and productivity losses due to illness. So, you know, even when I was a kid, this was a concern because we had President Kennedy. And President Kennedy suggested that, remember this, some of you, maybe you've seen it in the history books, he was talking about 50-mile hikes. Because there was a concern that the fitness of America was declining. This was 1962. That's when he was president. And I think things have gone south even from then, because I remember having lots of recess. I remember having physical education every day, every single day in junior high school and high school. It was mandatory. And we hated it, of course, you know, because they, you know, make us, you know, get in our gym shorts and, you know, they'd run us around laps doing push-ups, you know. We had these sadistic coaches and, you know, even when it was like 90 degrees, they'd have us playing, you know, football. You know, we hated it, some of it. But it kept us reasonably fit. And more I'm hearing kids don't have those requirements in school. And I think it's going to contribute to our epidemic of obesity and degenerative disease in this country. So the article concludes, as the prevalence of childhood obesity grows, so will the value of increasing physical activity. We need to be adding physical education programs and not cutting them. We need to encourage kids to be active, to reduce screen time, and get them running around again. It's important for their physical health and the nation's financial health. So there you have it. I mean, simple, you know, sometimes we're looking for these complex formula to save our healthcare system, and maybe the answers are more simple and fundamental and lie in lifestyle, not in some fancy budgetary maneuvers or new healthcare schemes. Okay, folks, well, that's all I got for today. I want to thank you for joining me, and I also want to remind you that we've made some transitions to our website at drhoffman.com. When you click on shop on our website, you'll be prompted to register for Fullscript, which is our new dispensary where we list all the greatest products that you've come to expect from drhoffman.com, products that we talk about here on Intelligent Medicine. And we encourage you to check it out. I think you'll find it user-friendly and a great way to support your health while also supporting Intelligent Medicine, a resource that I'm sure you want to preserve. Thanks again. This is Dr. Hoffman.